you know, like, what's in my brochure?
Yeah, you've got that.
I'm going in.
Have a quorum from the Senate side. 3 out of 5 makes a quorum, Charlie. That sure beat anything out of 9, but...
We just have quality.
So we're going to call this to order, and just for the record, this will be the first meeting of the Senate Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. And we do welcome our House brothers with us here, Charlie Power. I think everyone knows everyone, so I don't think there's any point in introducing each other wrong. We do have one bill that we're going to take up in about 35 minutes or so. And so we're going to launch right into the joint part of this thing. I'd like to introduce to you Sam Trivett, who's the Executive Director of the Parole Board here in the state of Alaska. He's going to introduce the gentleman who's up here speaking, and just go ahead and proceed with what you got there, Sam.
Okay, fine. If you don't mind, I'll go and sit down. I think you can hear me pretty well. To make a long story short, Alaska hasn't been keeping much data on parole for quite some years now. At one time, we were involved with data collection with the Uniform Parole Reports, which is a national data collection system set up through now through the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And I've been trying to get us back on board with this for the last 2 and 40 years since I've been working with the Parole Board. And in the process, I've been working with Bill Mosley sitting next to me, who is the Associate Director of the Uniform Parole Reports. And Bill is up here now primarily to teach my staff and some of the people from criminal justice the actual coding that needs to be done in order to have this data collected so we'll have the information. And I was talking to the people over criminal justice who are helping us to do the research, actually giving us the manpower to do it since we don't have the staff to do it. They indicated that possibly some of the people in the House and Senate might be interested in talking to Dr. Mosley, because he has been working for Uniform Parole Reports for close to 3 years, I believe. And in this capacity, of course, a number of other states are taking a close look at the judicial system and how it should be set up, how it's operating now. And in conjunction with this, Uniform Parole Reports has collected quite a bit of data over the years, which they have shared with various parole boards and other legislatures. And also, they've done some special research that is very germane to the bill. The kinds of bills that are appearing or surfacing here in Alaska. A number of other states have already looked at this kind of legislation. And in conjunction with giving these people information, they've done some special research that is pretty important, we felt should be made available to the people in the House and the Senate, since it probably will kind of tie into some of the bills we're looking at this year. Bill, like I said, is the Associate Director of the Uniform Parole Reports, which is funded by the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration and is seated at the National Council on Crime and Delinquency Research Center in Davis, California. Bill, do you want to go ahead and explain what you're doing and what's happening there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and other members. Rather than take the time to explain what I do, why don't I just launch into what I'd like to try to get into today, since you have other matters of interest before you. What I'd like to do is to try and present some relevant information on parole and on several of the determinant sentencing proposals which have been enacted by the state legislatures and signed by the governor, which are now laws in 3 states and in 1 proposal. In a recent article, a lady named Kay Harris summarized the critiques of parole in the United States in the 3 areas. The first problem, she said, is that it's been criticized because it is arbitrary and capricious. That is to say that the parole board decision making do not have explicit rules behind them, and that their decisions are whimsical, arbitrary, and capricious. The second broad area of criticism that Parole has had leveled against it is that it's counterproductive. And by this is usually meant because it has been characterized as arbitrary and capricious, it represents bad decision making, it creates uneasiness in inmates, and therefore it's counterproductive to the system. Dave Fogel is, I used to teach, and I have that bad thing of always saying, if you, here's a paper, if you want to read it, there's some copies here of a paper that I would be very happy to share with anybody that, that wants to take it. Okay, the first, arbitrary and capricious, second, counterproductive, and the third criticism, that parole basically does not work. That is to say, it is ineffective. Okay, I'd like to address those three critiques and try and bring out some relevant information. The first two that I'd like to take are the arbitrary and capricious criticism and that they are counterproductive, since that they are both very directly related to one another. It seems to me that when you think about parole, that people, parole boards are making two basic types of decisions. First of all, they're making individual case decisions on individual people applying for parole, and secondly, they're making policy decisions. And because parole boards in the past have not always made the basis for their overall policy decisions explicit, that is to say, they have not written down rules or guidelines by which they can formulate their specific decisions, I think this has probably been the primary cause or reason that people have criticized them for being arbitrary and capricious, because there has been nothing that they can formally relate to as, this is the reason I have made the decision. A recent study, recent of a couple of years ago, the group that I work with did a research project for the United States Board of Parole. At that time it was the United States Board of Parole. You may now know it's now the United States Parole Commission. Same body. And basically what they found was that parole board members, although they did not have an explicit stated policy or criteria for their decisions, when we analyzed their actual decision making, we really did find that there was a very distinct implicit policy which could be made explicit. And if you want to get the juice, Jeff, Amy. Okay, what we basically found was that for the federal board, there were three primary factors which were involved in their decision making as to whether to parole somebody or not to parole somebody, or let me put it in a different light, when to appropriately parole somebody after they had served a length of time in prison. And what they basically found again was that the three factors were offense severity, that is to say, from, I use, littering a national park to murdering and imprisoning the United States, okay, from low immigration law violations here to willful homicide and kidnapping. Okay, this was one dimension or one factor. The other factor was what we call an offender prognosis, a parole prognosis of how the board felt this individual would do out on the street when they were paroled. Now this was the result of a score, excuse me, sir, age at first arrest, number of prior convictions, drug addiction, alcohol involvement, things of this nature, hard factors as distinct that you can explicitly identify as distinct from subjective evaluations of personality tests, things of this nature, which could be subject to wide fluctuation given different people's interpretation. Okay, so what they did then, as you can see here, is they were able to make a what we have characterized as a guideline. Now these guidelines serve as, and I'm not trying to be redundant here, but serve as guidelines. And the point that I'm making here is that They serve to structure their decision-making. They are not absolutely binding. And so what you can see is that a person with a moderate type of offense who has a very good parole prognosis would serve between 12 and 16 months. Excuse me, sir. And somebody with a very high severity offense with a very bad parole prognosis would serve between 55 and 65 months. Now, when I say they're guidelines, they can be gone outside of. That is to say that hearing examiners can recommend that somebody be paroled much earlier or later. However, they have to provide explicit written reasons as to why the guidelines are being abrogated either above or below. Now, this could be for exceptional institutional program achievement, exceptional behavior. There are a number of factors that they have specifically delineated which could be reasons for this. The same thing, a number of bad disciplinary infractions would be a cause for recommending parole release later than the recommended guidelines. Okay. You'll probably notice also that when the low areas here, the range is much shorter than down here. Just a rule of thumb you can say is the ranges are smaller for the lesser severity offenses, and the ranges are larger for the more severe offenses. Okay, the guidelines are reviewed every 6 months. Review basically on two things. If for some reason you want to change these factors, probably the most important way that they have been altered so far in the 2 years of their operation is that various offenses, social moods change, and so they have been changed from low to moderate or downwards. For example, on the federal level, one change they have made is marijuana. Just simple possession used to be a moderate and has now been made a low type of offense. Point of it is this is just something that's discretionary, that as moods, attitudes change, you can make them more severe. The thing that they have increased, and I believe they changed it now up into the greatest, is terrorist type of bombings. That used to be a very high, now I think they have put that up into the extreme category. I have had to reduce a number of the federal offenses out of here, as you can imagine, just because there's limitations on how many typewritten lines you can get on a piece of paper for this type of exhibit. The other thing is they don't try to get every type of conceivable offense. They're trying to give ranges, and then if something new is in here that's not specifically a hearing officer puts it in. The basic point that's significant here is that they have made explicit guidelines. These guidelines do have a definite effect on when people are paroled. It gives them pre-notice as to when they should be paroled, given good institutional behavior. It structures the parole board's decision-making. It makes the guidelines open so that the legislature can, the United States Congress can look at these guidelines, can critique it so that the general public can critique it, and most importantly, I'll just say it again, that it has provided definite structure to their decision making. Now, are there any questions on this, that we've done this in other states? Oregon's doing it now, New York State's doing it now, we've done a study for 8 other states. This is something that can, this is a subjective evaluation. This is an empirical evaluation. Yes, sir.
If it's an empirical evaluation on that right-hand column, why would anyone with a poor prognosis be given parole at all?
Well, first of all, I think I would answer that by saying, except in very unusual circumstances, everybody's going to get out sooner or later.
At the end of a sentence.
Okay, at the end of their sentence. And I think this goes into one of the discussions maybe we'll have later about the benefits of parole. I would argue that I think that allowing somebody out of prison and placing them under the supervision of a parole agent provides a little bit more safety to the community. It provides them, it helps, I think it does two things. I believe that the parole officer, the parole system, can help the individual in the transition from a society in which all responsibility and initiative is taken away from them, and then they're released out into the society. Parole officers can help them get jobs, can help in counseling and a number of other areas, and it also provides, I think, a much more immediate form of supervision over that individual when they first get out, which we know to be the most important time between the first 5 months after release. Yes, sir.
Yes, in the county and so forth, control of take care, how does their caseload?
Well, that varies from state to state. In the federal system, I don't, you know, that's going to vary from district court to district court.
Well, the idea of this is trying to sell it to the people.
I'm not, no, sir. I'm trying to give you an idea of a way that decision making on the federal level and in a number of states has been implemented, which I happen to think is a reasonably good idea, and I'll go in and give some other. California is in a, no, well, under Rape for Punier, they did try to do something. Did try to do something very much like this. Yes, sir. I can't go along with that because if you're thinking of the legislation, which I'll go into with the California's passed, I think there was a lot of personality involved in that as well as substance. There's only three states, I believe, sir. Maine, Indiana, and California are the only three states that have passed legislation. Okay, well, if it's happened, it's been in the last day or two.
I think there are proposals in a number of states. I know Indiana's one of the longest, I think. California, I think, has passed, or Maine has passed, for sure. I don't, you know, there are a lot of others that are looking at carefully, and I think the reason why I asked that he's up here talking today is to kind of present what's happening on a national basis and some of the things that have happened. I don't think it's to try to convince anyone that it's good or bad. It's just primarily to present information and, you know, to give people an opportunity to see what has been happening on a national basis. So,
yes, sir.
Yeah, you refer to they as having established these guidelines. I guess what I'm looking for is who are they and what was the rationale, the wisdom, the knowledge, the discipline that they used to establish these? Was this, you said they were empirical, but did they have case histories that it's safe to let a guy out for 6 to 10 months up there in the upper? And how what bit of wisdom did they use?
Okay, they squeeze. Okay, what we did is this. We gave the parole board members a listing or QSOR cards, but we allowed them to rank in whatever fashion we used. We let them rank severity of offense from willful homicide here to immigration law violations. Okay, so when the seven members did this, we ranked them, we gave each a weight number, and then averaged them out, and we found some where there was a high degree of consensus, most of which there was a high degree of consensus in how they rated them between low and high. And there was a few where there was some variation in them. And then we went back on those and discussed those problem areas with them, and then came up, there was a consensus by the board members as to where they should be put here. Now, empirical, by this I mean, what we had is case offenses of several thousand people, federal parolees, who had been released by the board, and then we followed them for 2 years, had 2 year follow-up. And then we knew their background characteristics. So by multiple regression analysis and cluster analysis, we were able to relate what characteristics are associated with predictives of these people, 90% of them we can predict are going to be successful. Down here we can say that only 20% of them are going to be successful. So that's how we, that's basically, unless you want me to go into more depth, when I say empirical, we have the
backgrounds and did an actual statistical analysis of it. And I'm not trying, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not trying to sell you on anything. All I wanted to do was to say that parole boards have been critiqued as being arbitrary and capricious, and I think that this is a relevant model that the federal board and a number of state boards have used, which I think counteracts the critique of being arbitrary and capricious, that this is a very definite, explicit policy which they use to make their decision making. Now, for example, in the last study that I saw, which was a couple of weeks ago from Pete Hoffman, approximately 87%, between 85 and 87% of their decisions fall within these guidelines. The remaining 15% are above and below. And interestingly, about an even number are above and below the guidelines. Yes, sir.
When you made this study, how many cases did you involve yourself in? And what was the follow-up?
I can't give you the exact number. I want to say 2,300. I can send you the study of giving you the project that I work with. We have 250,000 right now that we deal with. And the follow-up period was for 2 years.
What is the follow-up?
Well, it's like with what I'm here with Sam on. What we did is we had case histories on each individual from the field reports. And we also, to cross-check those, we were lucky to get, we went through the FBI Uniform Crime Report, and cross-checked is another way, everybody's individual number, to see if there was any outstanding crimes that for one reason or another had not been put into the jacket. And in the jacket included, when we look at parole success, we're looking basically at three things: successful, no arrests, no problems, absconders, technical violators, and new major convictions.
And those that didn't make it, they focused.
Well, we separated out so that, and I'll get to that in a minute if you'll, I think I'll try and answer that with some specific numbers of actual data. Okay, the next thing that I'd like to go to is, which I am probably wrong on, but as of the other day, at least when I left California, there had been three states that had passed determinate sentencing laws: Indiana, Maine, California. These dates up here are when the laws actually became effective, and this is the Dave Fogel of the justice model, which is still pending in Illinois. From information I have, it does not have too much chance of success, but it has been used as a model for discussion across the United States, and so that's why I've incorporated it here. Sentencing alternatives to parole have usually included two basic elements: determinacy and a reduction of judicial discretion. The thing that I'd like to go into here, when we're talking about reducing judicial discretion, I think this is a very interesting table. The point that I would make is that I think judicial discretion in these laws has not been reduced. And I give you the examples in Indiana. Anybody with two or more prior unrelated felony convictions can be sentenced within the narrow range of 20 to 80 years. For a Class B felony with two or more prior, well, even here, with no priors, 6 to 20 years. With two or more, again, unrelated prior felonies, 10 to 50 years. 2 to 8 years, 5 to 38. I don't know how they arrived at this wisdomous number, but and 2 to 34. So I would suggest in Indiana here, judicial discretion still has interesting limits. In Maine, you'll notice that the first state to pass determinate sentencing was, they have a 0 to 20, 0 to 10, 0 to 5 for the top five. Also notice that the use of a dangerous weapon allows you to increase the class. So in other words, what would normally be a Class D crime, with the use of a dangerous weapon, allows it to become a Class C crime. So again, you still have, I think, very large parameters here for judicial discretion to take place.
Now, to take the interesting case of California, there was a lot of, well, there's a lot of things going on in California right now. But then we have Jerry Brown, who has a direct line up there, so who knows. In California, they hit three separate years. Now, I'll take robbery, because I happen to know about that one, or I'll give you an example here. Robbery in California is punishable by a term of 2, 3, or 4 years. Now, on top of that, you can have 5 years added for prior felony convictions and consecutive sentences. So in other words, I could be convicted of armed robbery, get 4 years, and let's say I had 3 prior felony convictions and I stole 2 cars in my getaway. So the judge could say, okay, I'm going to give you 4 years plus 3 years, 1 year for each of your 3 prior felonies, plus 2 years for the 2 sentences that I'm convicting you on for vehicle theft. Plus, if I used a gun, if I had possession of a gun, you can be sentenced to 1 year. If you use the gun, it can be 2 years. If you inflicted what we call, or they call, grave bodily injury, you can be given 3 years. So that gives you a range of, in this area, for example, of between 2 and 12 years. So again, I would say that you have considerable amount of judicial discretion involved there.
Dr. Mosley, the point though, you must give some sentence. Is that what you're saying there? In other words, the judge cannot suspend.
No, it's not a mandatory. The judge can just say, I give you probation.
We can.
Yes, sir. If the judge decides to give you a prison sentence, it doesn't range between 1 day and 10 years. It has to go, well, it ranges for robbery between 2 and 12 years. And it's very similar to this. It's between 1 day and 10 years. Now, in Mr. Fogel's model, I seem to be pushing more and more.
Mr. Chairman, before he goes away, I'm really not clear. You're saying that those minimum sentences on the left are not mandatory. If he finds them, if the jury finds them guilty,
no, sir.
The judge would not have to sentence them to the...
No, sir. They do not have mandatory sentences.
But I don't think that's quite my conception of determinate sentencing, but...
Well, okay, maybe I'm using a... Let me define determinate sentence. I make a distinction between mandatory sentencing, which the legislature comes and says, if found guilty, you must sentence that man to 2 years. You can't give him probation. He has to serve 2 years. Determinate sentence, by this I mean, when the judge says 6 years, the individual serves 6 years less any good time or work time credits given to that individual with no chance of parole. It is determined upon what the judge supposedly has sentenced for.
Why would they confuse it then by trying to predetermine the number of years that a person ought to, or the range, let's say, and then offer the judge 72 different constant factors that he can still manipulate from 2 to 12. I mean, what's really been accomplished in that?
The point, I smile because the point that I'm trying to make is that that's exactly the conclusion of my paper, is that they have, in all of these laws, and I haven't gotten to the supposed bell winner here that Mr. Fogel has done, I don't think they've made a big change. I still think that judges have a tremendous amount of discretion. You haven't changed a lot. In California, you haven't changed a lot. And in fact, it's very interesting, if I might. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'll share this with anybody without reading it. Basically, what has happened with the new law, one of the things that the new law said is that for someone who is in prison now, convicted before the new law went into effect, which was the first of this month, 1st of January, um, if you were in prison and you've already served longer than the new law prescribes if you were convicted of the same crime, then you are immediately eligible for parole. Okay, what's happened now is that, quote, basically, as Mr. Klein and others explained, the changes would give parole officials more time and more leeway in deciding which prisoners to stop from immediate release on grounds that they might be dangerous to society, which is the question that was raised earlier, which to me is very interesting. You've abolished parole, but yet now these people who should, under the terms, be immediately released under the new law, you don't want to release them because they're going to be dangerous to society. What in the heck do you think is going to happen in 3 years when this new law takes effect and you can't put those people off, give them a set-off date? When their due time is up, they walk, and you don't have any reason for holding them. Okay, the last thing on Mr. Fogel, you'll have to tell me when I begin to encroach on your time. I'm sorry, that's a problem of mine. Mr. Fogel has done the same thing in enhanced areas. Here again, whether the judge wants to assume, to take into judicial notice that you've used a gun or a knife. A judge in one district might say, yes, I'm going to recognize that. A judge in another district might say, that's okay, you didn't fire it, I won't take into consideration that you had the gun. So you still have ranges of from 6 to 18, 3 to 11, and so on. Okay, so without going into that, the point that I would simply like to make is that in the three states that have passed the laws and in the judicial model, I think there is still a very large range of discretion. Still large, not only within this, but I would add two other areas. The judge still has the discretion whether to even grant probation. And secondly, the judge still has the discretion of whether to grant consecutive sentences as distinct from just bringing them in here. Okay, one other thing that I'd like to go into here, because I think this involves, is very important for the amount of time served that people use, is good time and work time provision. In Indiana, you have day for day, you have three classes, day for day, if you're in the regular population. If you're under a disciplinary status, you get a day for each 2 days served, and then if you're in solitary confinement, you get none. The point I'd like to make here is that there is no vestiture provisions. By that I mean prison administrators can take away, up until the day the individual is released from the institution, prison disciplinary committees have the right or the power to take away all of the good time that an individual has accrued for some sort of a disciplinary proceeding. In Maine, you have 10 days per month, you have 12 days. You get 10 days for good behavior and 2 days for participating in an appropriately approved work program. Again, there is no vestiture. Investiture, by that I mean, at the end of a month, it's like a bank account. Once you've accrued your good time at the end of a month, they can't take it away from you. Okay, there is none there. In California, we have 8 months. And the way it's divided, it's vested every 8 months, and you get 4 months. And the way it's divided is 3 months for good time, and 1 month for participating in an appropriately defined program as defined by the California Department of Correction. Vestiture does accrue in 8 months. In Mr. Fogel's plan, he has vestiture accruing in every month, and you have day-for-day good time. One thing he hasn't covered here, and I'm not trying to be cynical, and I just don't know. If somebody has vested in the past in a prisoner administrator, I don't see anything in the bill to preclude a prison individual from taking away good time in the future. That is to say, okay, mostly, I can't take what you have in the background, but you better believe it, you're not getting any good time for the next 6 months. A possibility, I think, in legislation, I just bring that up, I think that needs to be handled. Okay, the point that I'd like to make here is the indeterminacy that parole boards have been critiqued for and the lack of rules and regulations. If you think about it, these good time provisions work up to 50% time. So what you've done, or what they have done, is to change this indeterminacy, quote, from judges and parole boards and put it in prison administrators' hands. And if you really even think about it, in these states, they're not even putting them in prison administrators' hands. You're putting it on the individual guard and sergeant on the cell block who writes these guys up, or ladies, for disciplinary infraction. So my point is that there's still going to be a large amount of indeterminacy involved here, particularly when this is the only, there's no parole board to mediate some of these things. And they're making a singular decision. I know I'm trying to go fast because I'm feeling that I'm infringing on you. If you have a question, please ask. Okay, the last thing that I'd like to go into is the contention that parole doesn't work. And here I'm going to some actual numbers. These are not hypothetical numbers. This is from data that we derive. Again, I work for Uniform Parole Reports, and we derive parole data from about 46 of the 50 states right now. We have 250,000 people in our file, and we get between 25 and 30,000 people a year. We follow them up for 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years. Okay, the last data that we have available, people that were released in 1974 and followed for 1 year, all the way through 1975. As an example, somebody released in August of 1974, we followed them through August of 1975. Well, really July here. Okay, what you'll find is at the after 1 year, 82% of the people were still out on the street and continued successful on parole. And this is in response to your question earlier, sir, that we have technical violations were 9%, rules violations, and new convictions, a new felony type of a conviction, of 5%. Okay, I can't say what you want to regard, or anybody wants to regard, as what works. But if you look at terminal cancer operations or business failures or whatever, let's be honest. Parole is a terminal intervention. A guy, this is our last try. I mean, he's been to prison. And I, for one, don't think that at the end of 1 year that 82% is that bad. Now, that's the value question. All I can do is give you the figures, and you can and make a judgment. But the point that I would like to bring forth to you is that, interestingly enough, parole happens to be the only area in the criminal justice system in the United States where we do have national follow-up information. So at least you can have the ability to look at some empirical data on what's been happening. Okay, why don't we go to 2 year follow-up, when people have been out for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, you still have three quarters of the people still out, successful on parole. You have 6% who have come up and gotten new. In other words, there's been a 1% increase here in new major conviction. Okay. If you have a question, I'm, again, 5% absconders. Obviously, the biggest area of your increase is going to be in your technical violation.
Makes you wonder if maybe they ought not to look at reviewing some of the, quote, technical violations. I'm not a believer in technical violations.
Well, okay, I can go both ways on that. Interestingly, you'll notice from 68 to 72, come here, 72, technical violations have gone down 5%. And Morrissey, I don't want to say has helped this, because this is one of those areas I think the Supreme Court was following a lot of states and the federal government in what they were doing of having a hearing. But there has been a significant drop here in technical violations. And the only point that I would make there is that I have some of your concerns and fears, but I think that in some instances, the ability to revoke somebody on a technical violation can forestall something much more significant happening. We could probably reduce this and not increase this.
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence.
Looking at the 6%, or the increase of 1% in return to prisons with new major convictions, how would that compare? That seems to me to be significantly lower than the rest of the population. Do you compare those to the population trends? In other words, at what, where's a correct threshold without it being a subjective decision or a subjective number? As you said before, 82% is good. At what, I'm trying to determine, where should the thresholds be? How do you compare them with society?
I don't, that is a value judgment. I would make the suggestion that we are being perhaps too successful in our parole, that we could maybe release some other people without having this go up very much. That's practical politics between when you're a parole board member and the heat's on and somebody's just murdered somebody, you start tightening up down here on who you're releasing, and then you loosen up as time goes on. That's, to me, that's the interesting question on those guidelines that we were using earlier. Because you can pretty well explicitly make decisions as to what kind of risks you want to release. So I come back and say, if I were a legislator, or you can have an effect on what kind of people the parole board want to release. And in fact, I would suggest that you as legislators have the potentiality for having more effect on length of time served that the felons will have in prison on parole board members than you will on judges. Because judges happen to have that nice little thing called judicial independence. Whereas parole board members, you can't come down on.
You seem to be making a point of that bottom line there, and so I have one question. Arriving at those percentages, what did you use for a major conviction? What type of crime?
Any U felony, sir. Any crime that resulted in a sentence of 1 year or more. So in other words, if I got a drunken driving, a 6 month on a drunken driving, that would not be included in this figure. If I robbed another bank and got a 5 year sentence, that would be included in this figure. Okay, this is 3 years. You'll notice that there, you know, a big change is between I'm out of order here. What you can see is the 3 year progression. 80%, 74, 72. Technicals go from 10 to 15, 5, 8, and 8. Okay, this is a group which we followed for 3 years. So again, we're dealing in the 70 percentile of successes, which I don't think is that bad. Now, the one thing I'd like to point out here, and I've had this problem, well, I haven't had it, but I've gotten kickback from other people, particularly in legislatures and the federal government. There is a study out in the Uniform Crime Reports, which perhaps some of you have either been cited to or seen yourself, where, and this is the one that Attorney General Saxby quoted as saying, 3/4 of all parolees are, he used the words, and I quote, repeaters. Well, now what that was based upon a sample of 5,000 people. Okay, it's on page 19 if you want to make a particular note in the paper where I've gone into that. It was based on a sample of 5,101 federal parolees. It was based on arrests, and according to the UCR themselves, there are 3 arrests for every conviction, and if there's anybody that you would think would be a high-risk group of being arrested, it would be parolees. When something comes down, they're usually a good prime suspect, so a police officer is going to be a little quicker to go in there and get them. And there's some other things. They said they follow them for 3 or 4 years, and it's impossible the way they figured it. The most important thing to realize is that where I'm talking about a 70% success rate, they're talking about a 70% failure rate, and they're dealing specifically with arrests as using that as the sole criterion of failure. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, but would the parole board might not parole, they're not required, presumably, to parole people that they have no confidence in?
No, sir.
Okay. And so here, even though there might be this a higher percentage of repeat offenders, it'd be after one served his full term and would come back to prison and would not necessarily reflect on the parole board's accountability.
All of these people in this table were paroled by discretionary action.
Yeah, I understand. And so the batting average there would be better because presumably they're not going to parole someone that in their wisdom they think.
But I come back and say, that's an interesting question to me. When we say that somebody is so bad that we're going to keep them in there the longest, we know that the longer time served now, we've done some studies that shows the longer time you serve, the lower chance you have of being successful once you're released. We make them serve to the expiration of their sentence and release them without any parole supervision, without any help. So what we're saying is we're making the losers serve the longest period of time, and we're not going to not only going to do that, but we're going to not give you any help once you get out. But your conclusion is right.
The statistics could say that we were right in that decision.
What I'm saying is that's why the federal system maybe has. The federal system has mandatory release, that the 2/3 of your sentence, at least you go out with a minimum period of parole supervision to help give you that transition. In fact, I would say exactly what you are. Parole boards aren't making that bad a decision. Exceptionally well. Okay, one last thing that I'd like to go into. This is a rather famous table for me. This is probably, you've all heard from the New York Citizens Inquiry on Parole in New York State that was chaired by Ramsey Clark Jr. Okay, this is the reason I say this is interesting to me, because the committee that did this, the group that did this, was so hot to find that parole didn't work that they misinterpreted their own data. Now, I went through a few years of graduate school, and at least I could lie on my tables if I wanted to support what I was going to say. Anyway, what it shows is that there are statistically significant differences between conditional releasees and parolees, and that is that parolees had a much lower return to violator rate or a much better successful rate than conditional releasees. What I'm going to do is just show you several studies, all of which have some serious methodological problem. But interestingly, they all give an indication that parolees do better. And that's all I'm trying to say is they don't absolutely show anything, but it's interesting, they all go in the same direction. Okay, the New York study is one. Again, parolees did do better than conditional releasees. Parole boards must be making some better decisions. This is a study in Wisconsin, compared parolees, mandatory releasees, and expiration of sentence. Again, without going down the numbers, just do notice that parolees were doing much better here than, this is such a small sample size that I don't even want to talk about it. And this is questionable. It is small, and I realize that. This is one of the flaws. But do notice 83% versus 75%. They were doing better in the Wisconsin study. These are two tables done in Florida. Now, this is kind of interesting. Okay, what you found is that in Florida, there was no significant difference between parolees and the other types of releases, even though it's lower here. Okay, but what you do when you look at follow-up by Florida Adult Institutional Release for people with new commitments, that is to say, put back into prison for a new felony, parolees had a statistically lower rate of no new commitments. 92 versus 82 and 85. So parolees had fewer new crimes. So what you see between these two tables in Florida, they're quick to violate on technical. But again, I'm being repetitive and I know, but interestingly, these studies again do show parolees seem to do better when they're released. Canadian study, a guy named Erwin Waller, interesting. Try to give you not only just United States data. Canadian showed, look at the difference between parole. Now, he's using arrest data. I'm not necessarily happy with that, but it's a measure here, and at least he's being consistent on parolees and not You'll notice the parolees had a much lower arrest rate than unconditional releasees. These are all cited in the paper, if you, and that's why I think I go over from England. Interesting study. What I've tried to do is, anytime I saw a study which compared parolees to any other form of release, I tried to look at it. And so this is the extent. 88 to 74% parolees had a much better, statistically significant, had a much better success rate than non-parolees.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, this is interesting. This is a study that's related to the PDM study, the guideline study that we did for the federal board. One of the critiques of all of the earlier studies that you can make is we did not take risk into account. That is to say, exactly what we're talking about earlier, that parolees were a better risk. They ought to do better. And so you're just telling me a truism. Okay, what we did on this study, or what Don Gottfriedson did, is we made an adjustment for risk, exactly that, and found, okay, you can see without any type of a, this is a neat way of doing it, wipe off your mistakes easy, is that with successes, parolees had 89% success versus 74 for mandatory release. Okay, if we take successes and adjust them for risk factors, please note, very importantly, that parolees still do significantly better than other types of releases. What I've tried to show you today is that parole boards can articulate policy. I don't think the arbitrary and capricious argument is a valid one. I think it can be circumvented. I think, I shouldn't say circumvented. I think that it can be adequately regulated with objective guidelines. I think legislators can probably have a more significant influence on time served that people serve in prison through parole boards, because they're centralized, they're small, and you can have a direct influence. And lastly, to the critique that parole doesn't work, I've tried to give you national data as well as several localized studies which have showed that parole does seem to do better than other types of release. Thanks for your
indulgence. Dr. Mosley, one question that comes to mind. In the various states around the country, how many states have so-called professional parole boards compared to citizen parole boards, that is, non-professional? Is there a...
Okay, I don't know exactly what you mean. Do you mean full-time?
Yeah, full-time. Trained, in other words, trained in...
The last time I did that, went down and looked, it was about 30-20. There was not that big a difference. That gets a little, because some boards have a full-time chairman and the others are part-time. So in other words, you don't have to be all part-time versus all full-time. The interesting thing is that what I did is I made a table, and if you like, I'll send Sam a copy of it, and then he could forward it on to you. I did a tabular analysis where I took all the states with full-time boards and all the states with part-time boards and compared the outcomes of continued on parole and so on, and there was no difference between the two types of boards.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. One other question that comes to mind. How does the state of Alaska stack up with the national statistics?
We don't
the reason that I'm here, sir, is to get to train Sam and talk to him about getting Alaska data to us so that we could make an analysis like that.
Oh, what you can do, in other words, is translate raw data.
Yes, sir.
Right.
We are going to have to excuse the House members. They have some people waiting over there.
We have a meeting just this way. So what I would request is that Lynn knows me. He's got my card and my address. If you have any...
You're mute, right? Okay, this is mute. So I'd ask you to just join us up here at the table if you will.
Can you stay here?
Sure, anywhere at all, Phyllis, because they're just...
Yeah, I'd like to have to...
We'd like to hear from you as to why you need $44,357 and why 356 wouldn't do it and the Dick Engen or
If you don't mind, I'll let Phyllis speak. Phyllis is head of reader services. She's worked with this collection for 10 years now and
great.
Moving on. Very behind.
Well, the photograph collection in the historical library has been donated by people and agencies for a good many years. And it's been hard for us to preserve and try to make available these old photographs. And roughly, we have around 20,000 photographs in our main core collection, some 5,000 glass plates, and many more negatives that have never been printed out or organized in any manner. They're roughly grouped according to subject, like transportation, ships, towns, that kind of thing. But most of the requests that come in are very specific. You know, someone that's writing an article or something for a magazine and he's trying to get it published, they say he has to have a photo and he needs a church in Wrangell, you know, the Russian church or whatever, or a particular ship and he wants it from an exact date. And so what it means is that we spend a lot of time searching through this extensive collection, trying to locate the exact material that's needed. The other thing that happens is, this is in response to mail or telephone inquiries when we're doing the searching, which takes a lot of staff time. If the people come to Juneau and are up using the library, they have to comb through hundreds of photos, possibly looking for material they want. And many of these photographs are very old and fragile. Many of them don't have negatives. We don't know this. We've never been able to match up the negatives and prints to see just where we stand in that category. And so this handling causes further deterioration to the old photos. Then on top of that, we have several very extensive collections that are in our storage area. One of them is the Alaska Steamship Company collection.
Skinner.
The Skinner collection of photographs, right. It could equal in size our main core collection. So we essentially could be doubling the collection, but you know, we don't have the counting of members there yet. I think it's going to be an extremely valuable collection. It covers all of Alaska. It's from the 1920s on. There are some older things in it, a few old albums from the Klondike Gold Rush era that I was looking through it to kind of get some idea. But not only that, some of them are in files like this, and you have old photographs, but you have blueprints of the inside of a lot of the old ships that served up here in the early days, various other information, handwritten data, and whatever. So it really provides, you know, pretty comprehensive, that's a ship, information, you know, on the photographs in the collection. Also, the Alaska Steamship Company essentially carried on the same function as the Division of Tourism. It did all the publicity photos. So once that's out and available, it should be a very good resource. Also, another collection that's come to us that we've not processed is the C.L. Andrews collection. I feel C.L. Andrews, who lived in Sitka and other places in Alaska, is probably one of our best amateur historians. He wrote a number of books, including the story of Sitka and the story of Alaska. And recently, 1,000 of his photographs are at the University of Oregon, and they have indexed their collection. Libraries now are really realizing the importance of indexing. And we have copies of these pictures in the library, and also many other C.L. Andrews things, including, well, this is a later album. After we're through here, you might want to take a look at some of these. But a lot of Alaska materials are scattered, and some of the pictures in our collection have come to us from Delaware, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Washington, D.C., and various other places. The other thing I really wanted to mention was I've talked with a number of people about their collections and what we might be able to, you know, if we might be able to get them. And several have told me they would be willing to donate the material to the library if we could give them some assurance that it could be indexed. One person was an editor on the Alaska Sportsman magazine and Alaska Journal, And that person has brought over several hundred folders of pictures, and they look like this. They've got the contact prints. They have the negatives already in them. And if we were able to acquire collections like this, there's a lot of negatives that this person would be giving that would be copies of things in our own collection, which would save us the cost of making negatives for things that we didn't have pictures of. We probably have indexed, out of the several hundred the person brought over, about 40 pictures. I'll pass these around just for an example of the technique we've developed, but you want to, it takes a lot of time to accurately verify information on the pictures. And this comes back to a very important thing I'd like to stress, that in order to verify, you have to usually get contact with people in the various communities, from which it was Kodiak or whatever. And while we still have a lot of old-timers around that, you know, where there's still some hope of identifying these old things, it would be, you know, the hoovest to try to start before much longer or is lost forever. Well, probably one of the things that got this indexing idea going was the Alaska Historical Society. A number of its members really emphasized to the library, they said, you know, why don't you have lists? You know, we need to have lists in our own communities of what's available in the state's photograph collection, because we're trying to do local history research, like at Yakutat and Eagle. They're trying to restore old buildings, and they said, we need pictures. We need copies of these old pictures, but we don't know what you have. And in order to produce the lists, you need to have something like this indexed to draw on it. But a lot of people can't get down here all the time and are unable to duplicate. Many of these things are one-of-a-kind kinds of things. So that's some of the kinds of things they stress to us. I might make mention of, some of you may be aware of the Pipeline Impact Collection of Ken Roberts, the legislature financed that collection. It has also, like many other agencies, like Health and Social Services photo files and a number of other photo files have come to us, as did that one. It's a tremendous resource. I think the legislature funded it between $70,000 two different years running or not. We're very glad to have it. I think we're going to find a lot of use for it. But when we think of the things that many people have given us for many, many years, I personally, speaking when I talk to people now, I don't want to add on another layer without some hope of saying, hey, we will really be able to do something more than just store it away. You know, I want to see it out and really be able to have it used, because, you know, I think we owe that to the people. Now, just to show, ask me any questions you want. I'd like to show you some of the things that I've been involved in acquiring a lot of these things. This is an early Klondike, we're going up to Dyea and Skagway on the way to the Klondike. But you'll see a lot of these pictures, you know, many are very clear, a lot of them are fading. Now, we have a lot of pictures that are in need of pretty immediate copying in order to save them at all. The glass plates, some of them, the ones from Yakutat, were 500 Yakutat negatives that were done by a Japanese man many years ago, and a lot of those are just peeling back. Also, there's a lot of nitrate negatives, and that's combustible. We know about it, but you know, it's something, you know, you should try to get them on regular film as soon as possible. But that's just another thing to think about. Nothing to worry about. This is another album that's come to us. This is from the Nome area. Absolutely fantastic, beautiful portrait done by Dobbs that was at Nome. In our collection, we're not trying to have every last picture that was ever done, but a good selective representation of that show the development of our communities, people changing styles, ways of life. Anything that has research value to it. Um, many mining photos are coming to us. We have, among others, agencies that contact the old Alaska Road Commission, all the building of old trails and bridges. I know the Division of Parks has, well, they've had people down working several days at a time, going through these many, many albums, trying to locate material. And people, you know, sometimes we borrow things from people to copy. Most people get very excited when they find that, you know, you're really interested in these things, and have been very good about wanting to place them in the state's care. We've got the procedures now for doing it. It's with the request coming in, I'll pass out. This location, this is from the last 6 months. Give some idea of requests coming in, number of materials that have been given to the library. We're not only interested in just straight photographs, but old motion picture footage, slides, any kind of material. And
Phyllis, I just, just determined where Volkswagen came up with the design for the boat.
Yeah, it's a little distance up 39 or 34, yeah. And then that Volvo, you know, was just like a 5/8 48 Ford. who would you hire to actually do this?
Okay, it would be a contractual arrangement. I would guess about $30,000 would go to having a person work full time on just indexing the core collection. I'm not going to say it would get the whole job, that it wouldn't, but it would, at least we would have a good start, and we would get something out to libraries. Probably about $4,500 or so would be used for the actual printing of a list.
What sort of skills would be required to
do
the indexing?
Okay, this Miss Bromberg that did this article, I had been in contact with her last year because we were interested in, you know, what pictures were done in Oregon. And she has a degree in, her parents are both librarians, so she has a lot of library experience, but she also has a degree in fine arts photography. And another thing is, when you see old original photos, which ones should be given some restoration and kept? They were done, ones done by the photographer at the time. If they're copies of copies of copies, forget it. You know, we don't want to load up lots of files with those. A good contact print and having a good negative will serve most of our purposes. But the old, really old ones, well, like if you're looking at Curtis's North American Indians, you know, it took a long time before he was really recognized, and now those kind of photographs are selling for, you know, $100 or plus for just a photograph. But he was considered an artist. And some of our photographers have been very good. And who's to say what your hints, you know, people like Dobbs, you know, might really become recognized for the things they did. But
We feel that the person who would do the work would probably, ideally, have a background in fine arts photography as a photographer, and interest and training in history, because of course we're dealing with a historical, either a librarian or a bibliographer's background in terms of the organization of the material and how to put it together in a logical sequence. And then somewhere along the way we want to have an involvement with a computer programmer, a systems analyst, whatever you want to term that person, because it is quite likely that a computer-based search eventually will be a more logical way to be able to manipulate the various types of things you'd want to get out of it. Now, some of that may not all be in the same person. So although we set an amount, it may be one, two, or three different individuals using their skills, you know, in order to put the package together, because, you know, often those paragons don't really exist. You just dream that you'll find it somewhere.
Mr. Chairman, what I really, the advice I was leading up to is, it seems to me that in some areas, areas of handicap, whether there's jobs that is a repetitive sort of job, and I'm really interested in providing as much work as I can for people who have marginal or limited functioning levels. And if any of it, I'd be inclined to support on the basis of providing some additional work for fun. Not makeshift work, because there's some very capable people, and I would more than I'm enthusiastically supporting a search for someone within the community that would give us our money's worth and provide some active employment for someone who might fall within the area of handicap, not to exempt the expertise required for the job. I know that it takes that, but as you said, this one person isn't going to do it all, and this appropriation won't be the end or the last time it comes before the legislature, most likely to do the job complete. So my bias is in that area, and I'd urge other members to consider support on that basis, is that we're available and that you make a search to see if there isn't some handicapped person who might find Nick Wright in this sort of work.
A good portion of the activity would be of a, I'm going to say, a sedentary nature, and I don't mean that you're not doing anything.
Like,
I mean you are fortunately working from a desk, mm-hmm. a chair, which would be an opportunity.
You're working with pictures. You're trying to make contacts in other communities where you Xeroxed copies of pictures, sent them off and said, you know, could you help identify? You know, maybe you contacted a librarian or you know of an old, somebody through the Pioneers. You get a contact to carry on, you know. Yeah, the correspondence kind of thing is very time consuming. We would like to see, it takes a pretty skilled person that will go with standardized headings. You don't just make up something. We want to have you, the way you formulate your subject headings, you use some standards like Library of Congress subject headings or Reader's Guide. If you don't, then we never have any possibility of feeding in with maybe what some other, like we'd like to cooperate with the University of Alaska, but they don't have out any guides either. In fact, very much would we like to have our indexer coordinate activities with them and maybe include some of their things in. Because when we want this thing to go out, we would like to give people a handle on what photograph resources exist in Alaska. We know in Ketchikan, the Tongass Historical Society has a pretty good group of pictures. A lady was in from Anchorage today and said she'd been working on a history of Prince William Sound and had you know, located a lot of pictures, you know, that people had.
Well, I would certainly urge you to attempt some contracts, subcontracts, something with the Pioneers or handicap or senior citizens groups or some place where the benefit for the rest of the state could be shared with people who have unique problems. And that's my interest.
Are there people within the state whom you could foresee would have the expertise to do this without going outside the state?
I really don't know. The indexing of photographs is pretty new. There was a fellow that had he was Filipino and he was working for the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and he was doing a photograph history of the interior, gathering material and trying to get identification. And he was the first one I knew that was really doing things in depth. We have tried to employ handicapped persons in the library. We
there
really
are those who think our entire staff is handicapped.
Yeah. Well, we've had several, and we've had that have been very excellent employees, and I agree with you. If we could find anyone like that, fine. I'm certain that there are parts of the work, like the communications and that end of it. So if we could ever get this down, what I'd like is to produce something, you know, a bibliography, produce a list. You're adding material all the time. You want to get that out, too. And if it's done by a person that has some knowledge of automation, where if it could be key punched, fed into a computer, where we could add material later, then we could generate another list later. You know, maybe in 5 years, you figure, you know, you've added so many thousand more photos, or added another major collection, and you would like to get this out. Because the thing I can't stress enough, when you talk about little places, very few of our communities have written their history, and they're getting interested. Particularly in bicentennial year, they're getting enthused. And all they have, maybe from some towns, are a few old newspapers and a few photographs. You know, a lot of people came into the state and left. That's why so much material is scattered throughout the country, and we are getting some of it back.
Mr. Chairman, how do you relate and help the community centers? You know, when I came down for the session, we happened to lay over an extra day in Haines, so we happen to locate the little museum that they have there.
She's helped us more than we've helped her. Mrs. Hackinen up there started this little museum, and she has a lot of old photographs. Well, she came up, and she wanted to get some things of ours, and we wanted some things of hers to help fill in. So we help fund, jointly fund, having some of those things copied and printed, and then the library got copies of them, and she helped identify, and she was able to take some back for her area. And also one of the Native associations there, there were some of the pictures were of their group, and they wanted them. And now these people from Yakutat, they've applied for a museum grant. They were trying to get some funds to help print out the glass plates. But a lot of people, through fires and that, the communities don't have old piles. Or maybe families have lost all of their pictures. Mm-hmm. And we've got some, and this one lady was saying, I bet you, she says, there's kids in some of those pictures. I bet I've never known that these existed. Mm-hmm. And Metlakatla had some old glass plates on Metlakatla that they wanted to get produced. We said, right, if you can, they got a museum grant to have a contact print made, and then we funded having, we will be funding, having negatives produced, and then we'll give them Xerox copy for a browsing file. They'll put the good contact prints away for safekeeping and not have them handled. And any requests people want to have them for own use, they'll write to us, and we will, you know, have glossy prints ordered to their specifications. But many people working on exhibits or just wanting to do local history writing. I know Ego was specifically interested. We went through a lot of our manuscripts. Some of them had photographs, and every picture we could find on Ego, we copied for them. And as they found things, they tried to help fill in our collection. But right now, we work on it on a time available basis. What it's done, the person supposed to be working with manuscripts and doing reference. We haven't done a bit on manuscripts for a long time. We're to answer the request that we're getting with photographs. Otherwise, we've got this, we're acquiring more material, we try to get it away somehow under these rough headings, and to take and handle requests and get them sent and help people when they come in, that's all the further we get with it. You know, I've tried to free someone up, you know, say, go back and grab an hour, try to index. Well, what happens? You no sooner get started, more people come in, and you've lost it. You know, you're up and down all the time. And to really do the job, 1 year will just bring a little bit of control to what we have on hand. But if we get that and start, you know, all I can say is, you know, we will do our best to keep adding to it. Someday I foresee that, you know, it's going to take a position to really do it right. You have places like the Oregon mm-hmm. Historical Society. I mean, they have quite a staff working, writing grants, acquiring things. Yeah. I've tried grants, two of them. And American our Bicentennial Committee, and I also tried National Endowment for the Humanities. And they all come back and they say, well, your state, you know, the state should be looking after their own stuff, you know. And so here we are, but I personally feel I'm contacting people, and anymore I kind of lose heart if I can't show them something that we can really do justice to the stuff.
Partially an answer to the question about the local community. It really is a joint effort. We sit here, and if there are pictures of Haynes or Nome or a barrel, we are probably going to get a lot more identification of the individuals or the particular buildings. And there's a great picture of a log house in there in the Nome. We don't know what it was, but I'm almost positive that John Poling or someone else in Nome is going to be able to give us more information. So we would try to send copies so that, one, not only do we get it identified, but it's an added benefit. They then know it exists down here. So if they want it up there for a display and so on, it's possible to, you know, to go the other way. So it's always a two-way street. We get the benefit of the identity, but they get the benefit of knowing, gee, there's quite a collection there that we can add to our new library building, which is going up there. So we work with the local librarians, the local museum, or the local historical society, or all three, and in all cases. And I think there's been a very good response and rapport with those places that we have contacted.
What would it take to try and going back to that Sherman's idea about trying to find someone local or Alaskan to do that? Assuming that there's no one here at the time, what would it take to, at least within the confines of the needs of the state in this sort of project, to train someone or to that would work along with the person that you have in mind to do this program or this project?
Well, we would, I think in all honesty, I think we can say in the past that we would try to look for an Alaska. I think the advantages of an Alaska, one, with familiarity with the state, it gives us a leg up on it to begin with. Two, those are the people we'd rather employ in the first place because we're the ones who are putting the money into it. So we ought to try to get all the benefit out of it, you know, that we can. I strongly suspect that we could find a competent person. It may be that the person won't have some of the expertise, won't have the familiarity with bibliography, the subject indexing that we want. If we can't give the training here, it may require that we will change around and provide a month or 6 weeks of Ms. Bromberg, either coming up here so she can work directly with here and involve this person in it. Because again, I guess the other real advantage is the person is here then. And if the person is here, we're very likely, if we aren't keeping the person busy on this, maybe somewhere in Anchorage or at the Sheldon Museum gets a small grant in Haines and they have 500 pictures that they can involve them. So if we can build the expertise to be available,
we have a direct rate rather than an overhead rate. You know, $30,000 at an overhead rate doesn't go very far.
That's right.
At a direct rate, you get much more for the money. That's some of the interest.
Yeah, I think that's one of the concerns with almost any of us is that, again, we don't want to add to the bureaucracy.
Well, you know, that's why we're doing it on a contractual arrangement. We are not trying to add a person. There may come, you know, I want to be perfectly honest, there may come a time when we come in, we say, we have gone this far, we see, here's what the project is, here's how we're going, at which time we'll ask for approval to add a permanent individual to the staff. But that's down the future, and that's not a commitment of this.
At that time, you'll, it may be more economical to do it that way.
Yeah. And you'll find, I mean, we know this too, because every time we've gotten out anything, we get to a meeting, we tell about new resources available. Once you get out of list, you generate requests. Because the minute anybody knows that you've got it, I mean, it'll go, and at that time, you know, we can say, okay, a lot of people know about this collection now. We're getting more and more donated. We've got more and more requests coming in, and maybe some year hence we can show you that now it's time, really, that we need a full-time person in charge of it. But if we get what has been built up over many years, you know, get a start on that, then if it's indexed, what may take us 2 or 3 days now, if it's properly indexed, should be able to be retrieved, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes. You know, if you can, they say, ah, that's just it, you know. Or somebody writes in and they say, I'm interested in, you know, numbers 4, 10, 20, whatever. And what we do is pull those pictures, Xerox them, send them back to them. And if that's just the picture they want, then they tell us and we send out an order. But what we do is Xerox a lot of things and then people can really, maybe sometimes just the Xerox serves their curiosity, sometimes they need to order. But, you're seeing photographs used in many ways as decor, in buildings. You know, there's a real interest in this old
just
stuff.
Not to get too far off the beam, but down here in Yancey Derringer, what in the world did they do that?
They photographed
fantastic Juno scene. We came to Alaska, my brother and I, in 1948. That's exactly what Juneau looked like. They just had about 2 feet of snow, and their snow removal system then was spring, and you know they just let it go. And we can remember walking in other people's steps up and down these dumb streets because that's all there was. How do they put that thing on the wall like that?
I must see it.
There's a photo mural shop in Seattle, right? The name slips me right now. That will do up to, I believe, 16 by 20 foot. Photo murals. It's one in. They can do. They now have the photographic paper that's 8 feet wide, and it can be 20 feet long. And what you do is you process it like through a huge sink or a big stainless steel one. But you can literally do it in a big piece. You know, just put some edges on a piece of plywood, 4x8 piece of plywood. Put the chemical in there, and in effect, you have one person standing here with it on a big long rod, and you have somebody else over there, and you literally pull it through, developing it slowly, and you dispose it the same way by throwing it on the wall, and it seems incredible. I don't know how they can do it. They got to do it out of little pieces, and it isn't. They aren't very many little pieces, as a matter of fact. It's not like a mosaic as we used to, you know, the photo mosaics that we used in the Army and Army intelligence and so on.
Almost like an OPEC projector.
Yeah.
Onto a
huge, you know, wall like this, and it's thrown onto it.
Chairman, Phyllis, in regard to the pipeline photos that Ken Roberts took, wasn't it a requirement, along with that $7,000 that some people think was almost a waste, wasn't there a requirement for him to index these and put them in some kind of an order as well as taking pictures?
Well, he started out, it didn't start out that way, but the library got into it after the fact
yeah.
a little bit.
Taking
and they did put an accession number on the pictures, and we have a list. Then when there was evaluation of the project later, Sarah Effenbaum did a geographical arrangement where Anchorage, and then gave a series of numbers within the Anchorage area, or to the Valdez area, or that. But we've got some control on it now. But if it had could have been planned, and this is why with this kind of indexing, we wanted to be able to plug into other ongoing things.
Mm-hmm.
And if more projects should ever develop, if they could be planned in conjunction with other things ongoing,
mm-hmm.
it would be better. But
well,
to be honestly truthful, yeah, it didn't have the kind of control
right.
that we feel we needed. It added another dimension.
Were some of them damaged from water, flood or something?
Yeah. In Fairbank. That was one of the reasons that perhaps you remember why it was moved to the State Library. They were in the basement in Fairbanks where Ken was living, and then they were in the back trunk of a Ford
yeah.
automobile and traveling along the highway. And it was at that point when I believe some members of the legislature heard about it and decided, hey, we've got to put them somewhere that they have a
right.
home to rest. And that's where
I understand that Alyeska has a good logical collection.
Yeah.
Yes, we have a computer index. We have a copy of their index. Their Effenbaugh.
We probably should have let them finance it in the beginning. Yeah.
Well, they did a lot. They have done a lot of the straight construction photos. Ken's is more of a social study too of the individuals and so on, not as much of the construction. So they match reasonably well. What we did manage to require, what Ken has done, is the identification of each of the photos and the individuals in it. So that what we have and what we figured was the best we could do, given the terms of the legislative grant that funded it, was that the raw material is there to do the kind of indexing that will let us do it. We don't just have a mass of 5,000 slides. We have the ability to put it together into a manageable whole, and we felt that was the important thing to get done. So we got the starting point.
The last two albums we've gotten in, I did have a chance to talk with Neil Menschel.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm very pleased. With the last two albums that have come in. One deals with the Hall Road and one deals with Women on the Pipeline. He's got photographs, these are black and white, and they're things that people can come in and look at, you know, and get a grasp of what's happening. But he's got where the people came from, something about each of the women, the kind of job they're doing, everything, you know, from labor to one woman's an explosives expert. And then interview tapes, you know, well, the problems they personally run into as women or as laborers on the pipeline. And, well, I know right now across the country they're doing things like trying to develop women's collections. And I said, oh, we finally at least have a women's collection. So that it was kind of interesting that. But that's something people can really look at. And it's presented in a nice way.
The reason I brought that up was I know the Department of Environment and Conservation was disturbed because it was taken out of their funds. They had nothing to do with it. They had it already programmed for something else. Bill Ray, I think.
Mr. Chair, one thing further. I'm inclined to support the bill, but in keeping with something that I'm going to ask from time to time, is after this assuming or making the assumption that down the road the money is appropriate for this purpose, I would really like to see a one page, nothing else, no report. I'd like to see what $40,000 or whatever it is bought. You know, I'd really like a report, but I wouldn't want it to take more than $20 to make the report. I'd really like to see somewhere what the $45,000 bought. We reproduced 45,000 photographs, or we reproduce 10 and somebody had scouted with the rest of the money. But somewhere it'd be nice to see some objective report as to what this bought, and it would be encouragement perhaps the next time an appropriation comes.
Summarize it. Right, and not like this past year, Ken Roberts took two pictures of the Senate, not even for historical purposes do we have a picture of the senators for the 9th legislature.
Neither one turned out.
I don't think they do for the house either.
When they brought around, he took thousands of pictures every day. He was shooting in there for a while, but nobody knows where any of them are.
That's a shame.
It is a shame.
Yeah.
I didn't historical.
Not because we're in it, but
you didn't get one in the house either, huh?
The
I thought maybe you just flubbed up in the Senate.
No, the future wants those pictures and.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they really got.
I'd like to support this bill too, but in line with what Senator Sumner was talking about earlier, with regard to the handicapped persons perhaps being involved in a program such as this, could we not consider perhaps a letter of intent going along with the bill? Within the parameters that the senator discussed earlier.
What would it be?
Well,
how we might want to coax that thing to rose. We don't want to tie it down.
No, I don't. No, just for example, I got a call from Anchorage today on a bill that passed through a committee last year, and I'm doing a little research on what was the intent. I'm being hard pressed now to recall just exactly, because we didn't formalize a letter of intent. So I just thought perhaps maybe in something very general, not to tie anybody's hands in the administration of it, but just to reflect what Senator Sumner said to us earlier in very general terms, that if
to reflect that it's
equal.
Our leanings, our desires,
yeah.
if it's possible. And then the report coming back might reflect whether that was possible or not possible, but it'd give us something to go on next time.
There would be, one of the things would be to produce a product which would be a guide to as many of the core photographs in the core collection that could be accomplished within the year. It's really too bad sometimes that they specify completion by an exact date, because you've got to find the person and getting started and familiarizing themselves. But as part of the introductory material in the guide, you could specify that this was funded through a particular legislative appropriation, that so many negatives were copied, so the negatives would pictures would be available, and the negatives would be available, that include so many pictures that have been indexed or included in this guide. It could really be almost the preface, to all of those annual reports.
We certainly have no hesitation to accept such a statement of legislative intent with the proviso that it is not so binding that somehow we can't do it. As a matter of fact, I think it's very good, because what it requires is that accountability that is fully intended, but is often enough not accomplished. It would seem that, one of the legislative intents that we had was included in the budget bill, which said we shall do a survey of schools receiving film service from the state film libraries. To tell the truth, we had already decided to do that. It was much better if the legislature told us to do that. It's got a lot more impact when we have responded, and you people, in fact, have asked for it. I guess somehow, if when you reported this, to the floor, your statements are the two concerns, I think, that there be a report back, because this is an identifiable item. A lot of things within state budgets, it's very hard to take this out, that this is what $40,000 out of the total budget bought. That's hard to do. This is a separate bill, and it can be rather clearly accounted for. So in your report, to the Senate in terms of recommending that it do pass on that assumption. If you recommend that it don't pass, you don't have to say anything. Yes. If you recommend it do pass, it seems like that would be a good place, with the understanding that special emphasis be given to, the employment of handicap where possible on the project, and that a report be submitted to the legislature following the 1 year.
Handicapped or the elderly cases, old photographs. I know a man is a good resource person in town, but he's got arthritis in his hand and he can't write. But he could provide a lot of information.
Sure. If I would be willing to entertain a motion on the bill with that proviso that a letter of intent be included, and I'd be glad to dream up something that is coming up before we bring it down.
I'd be glad to make the motion to that substance and for later approval.
Will you ask me?
And that's ask unanimous consent.
Are there any objections? In that form, and that'll be a unanimous do pass then with the letter of intent. Thank you very much for that.